Okay, today's date is October the 15th, 2019. My name is Jonathan Gerland. I'm at the History Center today with John Ippolito, and we're going to do an oral history interview. And John, maybe to get started, just tell me a little bit about where you were born and where you were raised growing up, and how you went into the archaeology field as a profession.
Okay. Well, I was born in Port Arthur, raised there, went to high school there, small Catholic high school called Bishop Byrne. I graduated from there. I went off to A&M and was initially an electrical engineering major. Midway through my sophomore year, the dean of engineering called me in and said, you know, you're really not cut out to be an engineer. Your grades are showing it. And then he said, if you can find another department on campus that'll have you, I won't have to kick you out of school. So I thanked him for being so candid with me and then asked if he had any suggestions. So he slid a business card across the table for the head of the political science department. And his comment to me was, as he slid the card, was, I hear they're looking for warm bodies. I think you'll fit the bill. So anyhow, I changed my major to political science. My grades immediately went up. I was having major difficulties with chemistry and advanced math. So there was no way in the world I was ever going to be an electrical engineer.
So what did your parents do for a living?
My mother, for the most part, was a stay-at-home mom. Now, she worked during the war years for Gulf Oil. She was an accountant. World War II. And then for a period of time after I was born, not long after I was born, she worked for Sears Roebuck store there in their accounting department. She did that, probably till the late 50s, I think right before my baby sister was born is when she quit. My dad did a number of different things. He was from the time he got back from the war in 46 to 51, he helped his father run a grocery store in West Port Arthur. And Dad was the primary butcher for the store and ordered meat and all that.
What was the name of it? Do you remember?
It was Ippolito's Grocery.
Okay.
Yeah. But in 1951, two things happened. Three things. I was born in June of that year. About 3 months after I was born, my grandfather died unexpectedly of a heart attack. And then about 3 months after that, the store burned to the ground. So Dad... my grandfather had done some investments, some real estate investments around Port Arthur. So they had family property in different places. My dad and his brother decided in the early 1950s, well, actually before 51, I guess in 1949 or 1950, to start a minor league baseball team. And their first season to play was 1951. They were called the Port Arthur Seahawks. Well, after the store burned, Dad took over managerial duties of the team for the 52, 53, and 54 seasons. And my uncle was, at the time, was working for the post office, but he also was an officer. It was a family-run thing. They're equivalent of probably a high single A or low double A minor league team by today's standards.
Did they play like the Beaumont Exporters?
They played the Exporters. They played the team. What was the minor league team in Houston? There were teams up here in Jacksonville and Tyler that they played on a regular basis.
Was it Texas League?
It was called the Gulf Coast League.
Gulf Coast League. Okay.
There were teams in Lake Charles and Lafayette in Louisiana. And I think as far down south, maybe as Corpus Christi. Dad did that. And then in 54, they sold the club. They sold the property where the stadium was to the Presbyterian Church. And First Presbyterian Church tore down the stadium, built a church there that stayed there till the early 2000s. I think they tore it down maybe right after Rita. It was damaged during Rita, and they had already moved the congregation somewhere else and had put the property on sale. But the only thing about that is that the main pulpit in the church sat right over home plate, where home plate would have been in the baseball stadium. So anyway.
Did any of your siblings, older siblings, had they gone to college? Or where were you? Did your dad or mom go to college?
My dad went to A&M for one semester, the fall of 42. And when he got home for Christmas, he said he had two letters arrived for him while he was home for Christmas break. One was from the president of the university saying he could come back. The other one was from the president of the United States saying, congratulations, you've been drafted. So dad went off to the Army. Mom went to a business college. It later became Port Arthur Business College. It's now Lamar University, Port Arthur. But it had a different name before it was Port Arthur Business College. I forget what that name was. But mom went there and learned accounting skills. It was a two-year deal. So dad went off to war, and actually, I guess in the winter of 43, he went off to basic, excuse me, and then he spent 2 years in the Pacific, and then came, was discharged in late 45 and came back to Port Arthur in 46. I have one older sister that was born in 1949. She also went to Port Arthur College, initially to be a radiology technician. And her first day in practical labs, she had to observe a surgery, and the sight of the blood made her faint, so they kicked her out of the radiology program. She ended up in a business kind of thing, too. So, and then I have a younger sister that was born in 1959. She was this late surprise. And she also graduated from A&M in 81. And she's been working primarily in the banking business and in nonprofits since she graduated. She lives down in Richmond.
Okay. So you, that kind of sets the stage for you going, and now you're a political science major.
So I'm a political science major, that's going along pretty well. But I needed to declare a minor at some point. Well, I had taken like three or four sociology classes.
So about what years are these?
This would be 1972.
Okay.
Late 72. Spring of 72 is when I took. No, summer of 72 is when I took my first anthropology class. The anthropology program was established at A&M in 1972 as part of the sociology department.
It was all towards your political science.
Yeah. So I was a political science major, and I needed a minor, a liberal arts minor. That was a requirement back then. So I took a couple of sociology classes because I liked them. I took some psychology classes because there was a girl I wanted to meet. So it came time to pick another sociology elective. Well, Dr. Vaughn Bryant, it was his first semester there to teach. It was the summer of 72, and he was teaching an introduction to anthropology, to cultural anthropology class, during summer session one. So I took that class and liked it. It was really fun. I think I made an A in it. I don't remember. So starting the fall of 72, they started increasing the number of classes in anthropology. Well, to make a long story short, when I got my political, when I graduated in December of 73 with my political science degree, my BA in political science, I had amassed almost 45 hours of anthropology classes. And by December of 73, anthropology had split off from sociology as a separate department and was just starting to offer graduate classes as well. So I needed 30 more semester hours to get a degree in anthropology, another bachelor's degree. So that was a spring and two summers. And so I stayed in school. There wasn't a lot of a job market for political science graduates in 1973 and 74. So I stayed in school, got my anthropology degree awarded in August of 74. And from there, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I stayed in College Station. I did I worked for as assistant manager of a pizza store for 6 months. That was kind of fun for a while, and then it got to be really tiresome. Working 12 and 14-hour days, 7 days a week with no break. So, and then I did some other odd jobs and started graduate studies in the winter semester of 75. Took some, that semester of the fall of 74, I took off and then was taking some graduate level classes. Wasn't sure what I was going to do in grad school. I took political science classes that spring. I think I took two or three classes. And then the first summer session of 75, I started a sociology class, graduate level sociology class. And in the middle of that summer session, I was out. I lived in an apartment complex there off campus. Was in the apartment complex laundry room doing laundry one day next to the pool. And I looked up, and there was a gentleman named Harry Schaefer. Now, Harry was the archaeologist on the faculty at teaching, and I had taken 5 or 6 classes under him. So there was this chance meeting on a Sunday afternoon. We're both sitting around the pool, and he had just recently separated from his wife, so he was, you know, brand new bachelor. But we're sitting there, and he says, "Hey, in about a week, we're going out to West Texas for the rest of the summer to excavate a dry rock shelter. Would you be interested in coming out for a week and volunteer?" I said, "Yeah," you know, no second guesses. I said, "Sure, that'd be perfect." He said, "We can't pay you." He said, "But we'll provide you room and board." The room was a tent, and then we all did our own cooking. We were on a ranch out near between Comstock and Langtree, on a side canyon to the Pecos River called Still Canyon. Like I say, we tent camped on the ranch. Our shower was a water hose hooked up to a windmill, pulling water up off of 600 feet of limestone. So the only person that got anything close to a warm shower was the very first person. Because the water hose had sat out in the sun all day. But once that hot water was gone, it was cold showers.
Cold, yeah.
So anyway, I went out there planning to stay a week, ended up staying 8 weeks that first summer. And came back to College Station in mid-August, and we were cleaning up artifacts or whatever and putting away gear. And Dr. Schaefer came in to the lab one day. He said, "Hey, we've got a contract starting in early September for 3 months down in the Freeport area. Would you be interested in being a shovel bum, shovel hand?" Sure, you know.
Is that what you were doing out in West Texas?
Yeah, well, in West Texas, everybody did everything.
Okay.
That site was called Hines Cave. It had 9,000 years of continual cultural occupation, starting at about 11,000 BC up till... starting about 9,000 BC up till 0 AD, maybe first century. So there were Paleo-Indian artifacts. There were archaic artifacts. There were some late archaic building into the early ceramic period, although there were no ceramics in the shelter. There were 2 sites actually on the top of the ridge above the shelter. Fire ring sites that had ceramics there were enough age overlap between the carbon-14 dates we were getting from those sites and from the shelter. There was probably about a 400 or 500 year overlap. So there may have been some connection between those sites and the cave. But it was 9,000 years of occupation and about, a meter and a half, a meter and three quarters of fill. So, of course, the interviewer can't see this, but it's about this tall, about four and a half feet, five feet of fill.
And you did everything?
We did everything. We excavated. We did profiles.
And you enjoyed it?
I loved it.
It was 8 weeks.
It was great. A lot of that had to do with the socializing that went on after we got back to camp. Because every night was pretty much the same story. Even though it was the middle of the summer, we'd build a campfire. We'd sit around and with cases of beer. Two or three people had guitars, so there'd be singing going on and beer drinking, and we'd stay up till 1 or 2 in the morning. And then we were up at 5:30 because breakfast was at 5:45, and by 6:30 we were headed off to the site. We were camped about 2 miles from the site, and there were no roads going down there, so we hiked from camp to the site every morning. We carried empty backpacks going, and then we carried full backpacks coming back that were full of rocks and artifacts and what have you. And then when we get back, we would catalog all the artifacts.
Didn't have four-wheelers.
Didn't have four-wheelers, and even if we'd had four-wheelers, you couldn't have. You might have gotten within a mile of the canyon rim, but you weren't going to get any closer than that. It was just too rough.
Yeah.
So. Came out of that summer in the best shape of my life, even though we were, like I said, we drank a lot of water, we drank a lot of beer. The last night out there, we drank a lot of mezcal and tequila, because we would go into Del Rio every 3 days. We had a rotation of folks. Every 3 days, we'd go into Del Rio to buy groceries and ice. And pick up supplies, most of that being, you know, a couple of days' supply of beer. Because we'd probably go through a couple of cases a night. There were 15 of us, I think. And so, you know, there was just this constant thing on that. We would work 10 days on, have 4 days off. Some of those times on 4 days rest, we would head back to College Station. We'd take Suburban full of artifacts and what have you, and leave at the lab in College Station, clean up, do laundry. Several times we just stayed in Del Rio. We went and got hotel rooms in Del Rio where we could get a hot shower and eat a meal in a restaurant rather than our own camp cooking. But we ended up doing that for 8 weeks primarily that summer. And then, like I said, when I got back, I got offered an opportunity to go work on a contract project.
In Freeport, okay.
In the Freeport area. It paid minimum wage, which I think at the time was maybe $2.65 an hour, and I got $10 a day per diem to cover lodging and food, which at the time, you know, I felt rich. You know, that was more than enough money to survive on. There were three of us, I guess, working on that project. So we rented a beach house at Surfside, split the rent three ways. And in 1975, that was, the total rent may have been $100 a week, or $100, no, it was $100 a month. So it worked out. And then again, we would buy our own food.
And what was the job? What were you trying to?
We were doing surveys for the Corps engineers on some proposed projects they had. Two of the large areas were reservoir sites for dredge materials out of the Intercoastal Canal. On that segment of the Intercoastal Canal from San Luis Pass almost to the Brazos River. We had two large, and I forget what the acreage was on those, maybe 2,000 acres apiece. Areas that were designated, they built levees, dug them out a little bit, and then that's where they pumped dredge material to reclaim it. And then the other part of the project was an expansion, excuse me, of the ship channel coming from the Gulf into Freeport. And that expansion, I don't know if it ever was completed, because we found the site of a place called Fort Velasco, which was right next to what was then the Coast Guard station, down there. And Fort Velasco was an outpost built in the by the Mexican government in the 1820s. It was taken over by Texian forces in 1832 and was used primarily to provide safe passage up, what was that river? It's not the Brazos. It's what the Brazos used to be, because the Brazos changed routes up near Clute. And I forget what this arm of the river is called. I'd have to look at a map. But anyway, it provides access to the Port of Freeport. And, excuse me, and also to the, now, modern days, to the Intercoastal Canal. Oh, yeah, Fort Velasco was built, like I said, to provide security for shipping coming into Freeport area. And we found, just through our historical records research, the location of where it should be. We did enough shovel testing to kind of, and recovered artifacts indicative of that time period to say, yeah, we think it's here. It was, like I said, we're us. Surfside, it's in a subdivision, you know, a residential area. And the Coast Guard station had like 3 acres and high fence that the station sat on, and there's support buildings and what have you. And that was part of the widening was going to, because that was already property in federal ownership, it wasn't going to have to be acquired. They were going to move the Coast Guard station to accommodate the widening of the channel. Like I said, we recorded Fort Velasco and provided data on that, nominated to the National Register of Historic Places, and when we did that, it put the quietus on that segment of the channel widening. So we had to, they had to go back and re-engineer and take, this would have been on the east bank of the channel. They had to go re-engineer and do the widening on the west bank of the channel. Well, the problem on the west bank of the channel is there were two World War II era armaments in that same area that were going to have to be removed. And now, in 1975, those didn't meet the age requirements under the National Register. They weren't quite 50 years old yet. They were maybe 35, 40 years old. So that was all the Corps of Engineers needed to say, okay, we'll proceed forward with that. And again, this was 1975. We spent 3 months, September, October, November, down there doing that work. We wrote the report over Christmas, December of 75, and into about March of 74, we finished the report, submitted it. And I don't think the project ever actually got implemented till sometime in the late 80s, early 90s. Corps engineers did 3 more archaeological projects around Fort Velasco, and there were elements of the fort that were discovered, but the overriding conclusion was that most of the evidence of the occupation had been removed and was destroyed. So anyway, that was my first job, and I was able to stay employed as an archaeologist starting from September of 75 until I retired from the Forest Service in 2011, and actually I kept doing consulting work until 2017. So I built a fairly decent career without having a graduate degree. That's a bit unusual. I was fortunate in that I was able to fall into places at the right time, get particular positions and all that. So, but I worked as a field archaeologist for most of from 1976 to 78, and then in 1978 I did my first job as a project supervisor, and then and all of these were with A&M, and we worked all over the state. We did projects in West Texas, around Iran and Sanderson. Excuse me. We did projects in Central Texas in Milam County, Rockdale, Taylor, Georgetown area. Did projects. The first project that I was project supervisor on was actually a land exchange for the Forest Service. They were exchanging some acreage
over the U.S. Forest Service.
They were exchanging acreage over near Huntington, off of 2109, to I think it was Louisiana Pacific. And they were getting that land, and in exchange they were getting what's now called the Stark Tract. That's the longleaf timber country out around Scrapon Valley, the lower end of the Sabine National Forest in Sabine and Jasper counties. And of course, all those exchanges were value for value exchanges. So they were given up. I think the land near Huntington came to about 6,000 acres, but the Forest Service acquired upwards of 10,000 acres in that land exchange over in a prime longleaf country.
And that was for both of you to consolidate.
Yeah, it helped consolidate boundary lines. A chunk of the property going to Louisiana Pacific, I think it was Louisiana Pacific, had been surveyed and was becoming a lignite mine. LP had an agreement with, I think, Shell Oil to mine lignite out of that acreage. Now, that never came about, because in the meantime, the whole lignite operation turned out to be not financially viable in the state of Texas, even though you had mines up in northeast Texas for the steel mills up there. You had a large mine near Rockdale providing lignite coal for Alcoa Aluminum. You had a big plant there in Rockdale. And then you had that whole strain of lignite stretched all the way down towards San Antonio in a probably 100-mile-wide swath. So you had lignite mine projects in most of the late 70s until the mid-80s, all along that strain of lignite where it had been mapped geologically. But very few of those projects ever came to fruition. Probably the biggest one I worked on that project, but the biggest one was over outside of Carlos in Grimes County, the Gibbons Creek facility. They built the power plant there initially as a lignite powered plant. Texas Municipal Power Agency was had been established by the state legislature in the late 70s, much like our municipal utility districts are today. But TMPA was given eminent domain powers to acquire land for a power plant, a cooling lake, and then lignite mining. Big time legal controversy ensued over that. It was led by John Henry Falk, the noted folklorist and humorist out. He lived up near Madisonville, because the lignite operation was stretching all the way up from along the Navasota River, from just south of Highway 30, almost all the way to Madisonville, taking in towns of Beat Ice. Carlos. Anyway, that project did come to fruition. They mined lignite there for about 4 or 5 years, and then discovered they could get hard coal from Wyoming at a much cheaper rate. So they shut the lignite operation down, did all the reclamation work, and started shipping hard coal from Wyoming in to fund that plant. And then that plant was converted from coal to natural gas sometime in the late 90s, early 2000s. But it's still operating. But we did that project. I worked on just a small segment of the survey, and then did two site evaluations for historic sites that we recorded. Going back, the 78 project that I did over here outside of Huntington was kind of my foot in the door with the Forest Service. I got to know my contacts with the Forest Service were a guy named Dwayne Strock and Clint Sykes that was in that picture. And then Dwayne's boss was a guy named Mitch Gerganis. And at that time, the Forest did not have an archaeologist on staff. They were trying to take care of their Section 106 compliance needs strictly with contracts. And anyway, make a long story short, the year 78 goes along, and right before Christmas in 78, I get a call from Dwayne. He says, "Hey, we're thinking of putting an archaeologist on staff here in Lufkin. Would you be interested?" Well, I had a couple of things in the works and was still in grad school because I was working and going to grad school at the same time. I said, "Well, give me till after New Year's and let me let you know." He said, "Okay, that's fine." So New Year's comes and goes, and about mid-January, a big project that we had bid on and been told we were awarded fell through. So in the case of most things, economics were going to come into play as far as my future, because at the end of January, I ran out of funding under the contracts that I'd been working under, and this new contract we ended up not getting that was going to fund me for the rest of that year. So I called Dwayne up and said, "Yeah, I'd be happy." And so the original setup was there was a program called the Intergovernmental Personnel Act. It was an act that was passed under the Carter administration, 76, 77, sometime during that period. And what it set up was the ability of people from academia to go work directly for federal agencies through an agreement where they wouldn't be hired into the workforce per se. They would stay with whatever their pay scale was with whatever entity they were working for. Their retirement benefits would stay the same. But they would basically be stationed in a federal facility doing work for that federal agency. And that's how I got into the Forest Service, was initially under an Intergovernmental Personnel Act appointment. And they were for 2 years duration. And kind of the idea of the program was that it gave people an opportunity to work within an agency, see whether or not they liked it, and then work from there on something more permanent. So that's how I came to Lufkin in February of 79. To work with the Forest Service under an IPA. I was a staff of one. I was responsible for all compliance projects on all 666,000 acres of the national forests and grasslands. I was assigned a vehicle. It was a 1966 Dodge Power Wagon with about 300,000 miles on it. Three-speed on the floor with a granny gear. And the neat thing about that is that on some occasions I could take, if I was particularly up on the grasslands, if I was going across a pasture, I could put the truck in granny gear and get out and walk alongside it if I had to. And it wasn't a very easy driving truck, but it was functional. Anyway, so 78 or 79 and 80, I'm on the IPA. Like I said, it was for 2 years. I was asked if I'd be willing to extend for another 2 years. I said sure, because I was kind of settled into the job. I was enjoying it.
So who did you report to?
Dwayne Strock was my immediate supervisor, and like I said, Mitch Gurganis was our
assignments come through him?
Too? Assignments came from Mitch to Dwayne to me. Now, Mitch worked as
a
staff officer. He was the recreation and fire staff officer.
Okay, Mitch.
Mitch Gurganis, Gurganus.
Okay.
Now, Mitch left the Forest Service in early 1980, went into private industry, and then the guy that came in behind him was a fellow named Jim Page. And Jim was here till about 86, I guess, or 87.
So what were some of the typical jobs that you
had? Mostly had to do with timber sales. And at that time, we were still doing clear cuts, 40-acre clear cuts. So we would.
So these were already established plantations?
They were already established plantations for the most part. Again, it was even age management. So, I would get a project proposal. It would be about a 2-acre log landing and then 30 to 40 acres of clear cutting. And so I would go out prior to the sale and look at the area that was going to be the log landing. And then I would go back after the sale and look at the area that had been clear cut because they were thick plantations. You weren't going to get anything done. You couldn't see the surface of the ground to look for surface artifacts. There wasn't enough elbow room within the plantation to do shovel testing, so you weren't going to be able to do any shovel testing. So I worked with the Historical Commission informally to get an agreement that when it came to even age management, I could look at the clear cuts after they had been harvested. That way I had exposed surface, I could see landforms more clearly, and I had room to shovel test in areas where I needed to shovel test. So it was probably the, most of my work for those first five, six, probably first dozen years was doing timber harvest, pre-timber harvest surveys of one type or another. Pre-harvest surveys of the log landings and the roads. We had a process built.
But now when you say surveys, you're not meaning archaeological surveys.
Yeah, archaeological surveys where I would go out and walk a proposed route of a road, a timber sale.
But you
road.
Wouldn't do any shovel tests.
I would do some. At that time, I was still working under the premise that I was looking for surface artifacts to indicate where sites were. I was looking for landforms and surface artifacts.
But this is already...
Because that's what I was used to.
But this is already established plantations.
This was already established plantations. The landforms had already been modified. Even in those areas where you have mature timber, the landforms had already been modified many, many times over. So I was doing shovel testing as a supplemental survey technique, not as a standard survey technique. And then starting in about 85 or 86, my philosophy changed to where when I would do a survey, it was shovel testing at known increments, whether they'd be 10 meters, 20 meters, whatever, down a road. If it was a timber sale or something more than like that, then I would do
now,
several
was that your
transects.
Decision?
That was my decision, yeah, because at that point, I wasn't finding much, and I knew there were sites out there. I was building a database of areas that had been surveyed and at what level, and a database of sites that had been recorded. I had all of the data from the surveys that were done in the late 50s, early 60s for Toledo Bend, Sam Rayburn, and Lake Conroe. Right before I had started my tenure with the Forest Service in 79, the Forest had a contract with the University of Texas Archaeological Research Laboratory, where all the site files were curated for the state, and they still are. That contract was to provide an inventory of all sites within the Forest Service proclaimed boundaries and administrative boundaries. So the way that contract went is that forest maps from the time were sent to TARL. Somebody on their staff.
And that's TARL.
TARL. Yeah. Sat down with forest maps and with corresponding quad maps and then plotted the locations of all the sites that were in the records. So we had virtually all of Sam Rayburn, virtually all of the Texas side of Toledo Bend, and everything on the north side of Lake Conroe. And they provided, there were plots on maps, there were site forms, references to any publications to those sites.
And that's Forest Service land, the Angelina Sabine,
David Crockett, Houston. Sam Houston, then the Caddo and LBJ grasslands. And the LBJ grasslands are in Wise County, the Caddo grasslands are in Fannin County.
So all those work for the Big Lakes, that was all at TARL?
That was all at TARL, okay. Yeah. And all the artifacts recovered from there. All the burials recovered from those projects. Of course, one of the things I discovered is that a lot of that data wasn't much help to me because, particularly on Rayburn and Toledo Bend, the survey emphasis was on locating large village sites in the floodplains that were going to be inundated. There was very little attention paid to what ended up being the shoreline margins, which were the ridges where your archaic and early ceramic sites were going to be found. The villages were all late ceramic, late prehistoric, and they were all down in the bottoms in closer proximity to the channels. So in terms of trying to do any kind of predictive modeling, I had tons of data. If I had areas equivalent to the Angelina River or the Sabine River or Toyac Bayou, for instance, or the San Jacinto River, if I had uninundated areas of those watersheds, then I could take that data and build a model, a predictive model on where sites might be. But I had virtually nothing on the shoreline margins or now the shoreline margins. And we knew there were sites there because they had already started eroding out. All along the shores of Sam Rayburn, you've got sites that were not recorded during those surveys because they were outside of the flood pool, but they ended up being right on the shoreline. And a young man named Kerry Weber was one of the core engineer employees on Rayburn when I started work here. Kerry also had an anthropology degree from A&M. He and I had some classes together. He was about 2 years behind me. But he got into recreation management and that line of work rather than archaeology. But archaeology was still a hobby to him, so he took it upon himself to start recording sites and collecting artifacts along Sam Rayburn, along the shoreline. And when I moved here...
wasn't his official job.
That wasn't his official job. It was something he did on his own time, on weekends. On weekends, he would get in his boat and just go putter up and down shorelines, get out and look for artifacts.
Did he turn stuff into tarl?
He curated as much of it as he could at his office at the core, until probably 1985 or 86. And then we worked an arrangement where I took over curation responsibility for most of the artifacts that he had recorded or recovered, and then we eventually put those in our collection, and now they're at Texas State, I guess.
San Marcos.
But Kerry, when he left Sam Rayburn...
But some of that could have come from the core land?
It was core land. What we tried to focus on in terms of what we transferred to the Forest Service was shoreline property that was adjacent to Forest Service boundaries, because the Forest Service did not own all the way down to the waterline. There was a dedicated easement that the Corps of Engineers was responsible for. Basically, from the tree line to the water's edge was Corps of Engineer responsibility. From the tree line on into the forest was Forest Service responsibility. Even though you might have had 30 years of erosion that ate away at the shoreline, it was a floating boundary line.
And that it always, yeah, between a dozen
it,
foot.
It depended on where the tree line was versus where
above
the
full pool.
Yeah. So we focused on those sites, and there were probably 25 or 30. But that kind of helped with building beginnings of building a database and predictive modeling of where we could go look, where we expect to find sites in the forest general. So in 1983, my second extension of the IPA was due to expire. You were only allowed two-year terms. So Jim Page was the staff officer then. He and the forest supervisor decided I needed to stay on permanent. So then we started the whole...
And who was the supervisor then?
At that time, it was... would have been Mike Lannon. Mr. Courtney... John Courtney was the forest supervisor when I started work in 79. He retired in the spring of 1980. And then Mike came on sometime in the late 80, and he was here till 84, 85. So anyway, that started a hiring process, and I got selected for the job.
Did you write your own job description?
Basically, yeah. Got to write my own job description, quals, But I had to go through the whole thing competitively because that's the way the rules were written and still are. So beginning in my first date in terms of being a permanent employee of the Forest Service would have been February 1st of 1984. And that date was important to me because January 31st of 1983 was the cutoff date for being eligible for the Civil Service Retirement System and then having to be as part of the new Federal Employees Retirement System. CSRS was a much better deal in terms of retirement. So I missed about 31 days being part of CSRS. And so started, and again, it was still the same job. Up until 1994, I was still a one-man show doing everything by myself, trying to keep up with the workload and failing miserably most of the time, but still able to keep the wolves off the Forest Service's back as far as what we were, as far as our timing of surveys and
Were you still following timber harvest activities?
Still primarily following timber harvest, but beginning in, gosh, I guess beginning in the mid-'80s, 85, 86, about the time we started working on the forest plan in 86, we changed our way of doing business, and as primarily as a result of the lawsuit.
Say a little bit about the lawsuit, just so we know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the lawsuit was filed by Ned Fritz and what was the precursor of the Conservation Alliance. Ned had an organization. They filed a lot. Anyway,
T. Conner,
Texas Commissioner of Natural Resources. They filed a lawsuit in the mid-'70s, I think 76, against the Forest Service for not abiding by our own regulations under National Forest Management Act and the Endangered Species Act. Their main contention was that the way we were harvesting and planting harvests were destroying habitat for the red-cockaded woodpecker and damaging water quality. And that lawsuit drug on, when was it finally resolved, in the late 90s, maybe? But in response to the lawsuit, like I said, in the mid-'80s, we started changing our way of doing business and getting away from even age management into selective cutting, seed tree cuts, those kinds of things. Complicating all that was starting in 1979, on about a four-year cycle, we would have these large outbreaks of southern pine beetle. Excuse me.
Yeah, go ahead.
And the SPB work, the salvage work aligned with SPB control. Southern pine beetle ended up taking up the vast majority of our resources for the timber program in terms of people, timber markers, surveyors, those kinds of things, harvest inspectors. We were just constantly, starting about 79 up until I think the last big outbreak might have been in 91 or 92, and like I said, on a 3 to 4 year cycle, that would just consume everything for a year or two. So another part of that was that the forestry science, the foresters, also realized that doing strictly even age management and having those large areas of similarly aged timber at those ages that were conducive to SPB infestation was not the best way to do business. So it was the SPB plus the effects of the lawsuit that generated the change in the way we did business and went to more thinning sales, selective cutting, that kind of
stuff. So how did y'all do that on established pine plantations? Was it gradual conversion?
You just had to make a decision, draw a line in the sand on this date. From this date forward, we're gonna change the age class from an even aged to an uneven age and do it by a selective cutting at different stages.
This may be beyond what you were involved with, but like the last cut of a plantation, you know, you did the pulpwood cut and then you do the final harvest. So what did y'all do with that? I mean, did y'all leave certain trees?
We left trees.
Did you plant?
No, of course we left seed trees in most of the areas, particularly.
So if you did the first thinning.
We did the first thinning, and then we go in and do the next cut, and then the next cut was selective, and we left seed trees. Pretty much got away from mechanical site prep and mechanical planting.
And
at about that time.
It's still all pretty much loblolly.
But
right?
It's still all loblolly. You're trying to manage it as longleaf. We did some conversions during that period of time.
And what do you mean by conversions?
From loblolly to either shortleaf or longleaf. Okay. Primarily into longleaf. And again, it was focused on the lower end of the Angelina and the lower end of the Sabine, where longleaf was already well established. We were actually a testing ground for a number of years for different types of containerized seedlings and doing morbidity studies and all that and survivability as they were trying to, I think 5 to 10 acre plots.
So how did that affect what you were doing?
Well, it changed the way I had to go about doing archaeological work because we went from doing a 25, 30, 40 acre clear cut was pretty easy to survey because it was a well-defined boundary. There weren't going to be any landforms in there that were interesting. You could see them pretty easily. It took, on average, maybe 2 to 3 weeks to do the field work on a clear cut. We went from doing things in 25 to 40 acre increments to doing things in 2,000 to 4,000 acre increments. On some of these sales. So there was no way in the world as a staff of one that I could keep up with the workload on the timber sale program, as well as, because I also had to deal with the southern pine beetle work. That also fell under the criteria for archaeological work under Section 106.
Because that would be harvesting as well.
Harvesting as well, and salvage
harvesting. So you were chasing all that.
So we were chasing all of that, and in those cases, those mimicked the even age management style pretty much. So we would look at, I would go out and I'd look at transportation needs, any access roads, and then the log landings, the log decks, and then skid trails, because everything would be skidded to a central location.
I get a sense you're going to lead into hiring staff. So,
yeah.
So I don't want to omit that, but back up if you would, and this answer may extend into having staff as well, but what were you looking for when you did these? You know, when clear cut or not clear cut,
yeah.
But when you were doing your stuff, what were you looking for?
I was primarily looking for stone artifacts and ceramic artifacts. At that stage of my career, I was still considering myself more a prehistoric archaeologist rather than a historic archaeologist. I really didn't care about the early 20th century homesteads or the late 19th century homesteads. I was somewhat interested in the old sawmills because we had Aldrich on the Angelina and we had the 4C.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that.
We had the 4C structures on the Davy Crockett, and we were at that time getting into interpretation activities as well, so I focused on those. But really, outside of that,
So if you found an old iron lock from a musket or granny's glasses or something like that,
if I could look at it and definitely say this was predated 1900, I would note it, I would record it, I would do other collections in the area, maybe a little bit of shovel testing to see. I would go back then after the fact and do the land records research to see if there are any old homes, or because most of our acquisition records at the time the forest was acquired, those lands were acquired in the 30s. Most of those acquisition records came with building inventories, what was on the property at the time it was acquired, and where those buildings were located. So if I found an area, for instance, doing a project over.
A lot of that could have been even tenants' homes.
Oh yeah,
not necessarily the owner, but
yeah, most of them were tenants'
most
homes because a lot of the you still had tenant farming going on up until the late 40s, early 50s.
After the government owned.
There were provisions in the acquisition to allow the tenants to stay for a period of time until they could find other places to move.
Yeah.
They weren't immediately kicked out. They were given, I forget if it was 10 or 15 years. So we had those records. So, yeah, if I found a bunch of historic glass or square nails or like I said,
was that a hard date, 1900? Or
it was a hard date in my mind.
Okay.
At that time, I wasn't concerned with historic sites post 1900, except for the sawmills.
That's your decision.
That was my decision. Speaking archaeologically, it was a bad decision. But it turned out not to be a huge issue because once I got additional staff, we then started focusing more on some of the historical components as well as the prehistoric. And fortunately, with the change in the way we'd started harvesting, the impact on the landforms was minimal or non-existent. So we were able to go back into those areas and look for the historical components that were there.
So now there may be guidelines from U.S. Forest Service, but if I'm hearing you right, there really wasn't much of a guideline during your time,
the guidelines
for prehistoric.
Yeah, the only guidelines we had to work by were the Code of Federal Regulations, Section 36, which is all the regulations that were created in response to the Antiquities Act of 1906 and the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. Then there was something called the Moss-Bennett Bill, 1968, which the Moss-Bennett Bill...
And this is all federal lands?
All federal lands. Okay. The Moss-Bennett Bill was particular to Corps engineers projects,
okay.
Lands that were going to be federal but hadn't been acquired yet. Basically, the Moss-Bennett Bill just brought all of those lands. Say if the Corps was proposing to build the Rockland Dam and Lake, for instance, if they were going to bring that back, Moss-Bennett Bill, even though they didn't own the land, Moss-Bennett Bill would give the Corps the authority to conduct the environmental studies that were necessary, including the archaeology. So we had those regulations, but they're pretty broad because and then within the Forest Service, we had a Forest Service manual, an entire section, 2360, devoted to cultural and historical resources.
You did have that when
we did have that.
When you
but started. Again, it was broad and general, and left a lot of discretion to the on-field personnel as to how the manual was interpreted and how it was applied in their particular circumstances. Because when you're looking at the entirety of the United States, there were things in the Southwest, for instance, that didn't apply in the Southeast. In terms of the types of sites, the types of artifacts, the impacts on those sites and artifacts. And so the regulations in the manual were written vaguely enough to, again, to give you some local discretion on how you went about doing things. I tried to take full advantage of any leeway that I was given because, like I said, I was a one-person staff with anywhere from by the time we made the switch the harvest method, I was probably looking at upwards of 20,000 acres a year that were being impacted or being planned. And I had to find whatever shortcuts I could to stay on top of the necessary compliance-related activities to keep us in good stead with the Historical Commission.
So this is mostly since especially when it was a pine plantation. I mean, these are uplands, right? I mean, they're not.
Yeah, they're.
Were y'all doing any logging in the bottoms? Was there any hardwood?
No hardwood going at all. The only hardwood I recall being harvested on a regular basis was that might be needed to clean up after a southern pine beetle.
Okay.
Infestation. But generally, I mean, if you
that,
had
that would be more where you might find the Indian.
Generally,
artifacts,
if you had a large enough hardwood component, the southern pine beetle wasn't going to be a problem.
Right. But it's that transition,
that transition
between the bottoms and the uplands.
Right.
So did you get to do much of that? I mean, was there? I mean, I'm just trying to envision, because my next question would be, what did you find prehistoric?
Well,
overall,
yeah,
I mean, you don't have to tell me the site or anything.
Yeah,
but we
got to do some of that in different locations.
Did you get discouraged?
on a daily basis, yeah. That's why starting in about 1991, I started whining about needing extra staff. Excuse me. Especially since I was being brought in to more and more things that didn't involve field work. I was assigned to the forest planting team, for instance, in 86 to develop the forest plant, forest management plan. I was part of that. Well, that was initially about one day a month. Then it became one day every 2 weeks. Then it became one day every week. And then it became multiple days every week until the plan was finished. But as a staff of one, I couldn't do what was expected of me for that. And at the same time, take care of the field work.
I don't want to jump around, but I may do it anyways. When you say the forest plan, 86, it sounds like, I mean, what was the significance of that?
The National Forest Management Act of 1976 dictated that all national forests in the system develop a forest management plan that was environmentally sound, economically viable, and sustainable.
Did it state and by state or
it
forest
was forest by forest?
By forest.
It started out early on as what were called unit plans. And there was one done for the Sam Houston, one done for the Angelina, one done for the Davy Crockett, one done for the Sabine. Those were all done not long after the NFMA passed or was established, which I think was 96, or 76. NFMA may have been even earlier in the 70s. I don't remember. So anyway, those unit plans were done. Well, then the regulations changed as NEPA regulations were integrated. Following the passage of the National Environmental Policy Act, the NEPA regulations overrode some of the regulations under the National Forest Management Act. In some cases, they overrode. In some cases, they supplemented. Well, the NEPA process involved a much more holistic look at things from an environmental standpoint than our old unit plan did. So then it became you had to do a unit plan for your entire forest, all four administrative units and the grasslands, and do an initial plan and then revisit that plan every 10 years. So, and basically write a plan revision. So in our case, it would have been 86, 96, 2006, 2016. What happened? Because keep in mind that during the time we were making this transition in forest planning, we were still fighting the lawsuit with Mr. Fritz and T. Connor. So all of these things were kind of integrating at the same time. And what pretty much happened is that we tried to write that first initial plan basically as a response to the issues brought out in the lawsuit. I don't know that we were successful. We made some inroads. A lot of that whole contentiousness with the lawsuit boiled back down to credibility and personalities. You had the competing interests that were completely dug in on either side of the issue and weren't going to compromise, weren't going to give in. And it really wasn't until those individuals were out of the picture. They had either retired or moved on, that we started getting to the point where we could communicate, discuss, compromise where needed, agree to disagree in those cases where there just wasn't any way we could have, our philosophies were just too far polarized. But we were able to establish some working relationships, very tenuous at first, but they kind of grew over the years, with people like Larry Shelton and George Russell and those folks.
Now, were you involved? I know in later years you became higher up in management and even filled in as interim supervisor, didn't you? Off and on?
Oh, no more than they didn't trust me with that for more than a week at a time.
Oh, okay. But how much were you involved with it at the time we are in the story? Which I guess is 86, the
86
management
with
plan.
Management plan?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, it started out when we started.
You said you went from once a month to twice a month, four times a month,
yeah.
And then several times a
week.
And
then several times a week. And that transpired over the period from about beginning in probably early 85 till the end of 86. I think we finished the plan, sent it to the printer right before Christmas in 86.
So I think I'm really jumping around here, but I don't. If you think chronologically, we need to go back to the archaeology.
Yeah.
Let's do it. But I also want to talk about, maybe that is a good point, because you're suggesting, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that the plan was even a result of changes, whatever the changes
yeah.
might be,
yeah.
changes from within, changes from without.
So
let's talk about that, if either now or later.
Right.
Because your career covers that period.
Yeah, and we'll go ahead and talk about it now, because
okay.
you're right, exactly right. Because what happened, and I'm wrong on my dates on when we finished the plan. Because
we can get that later. But
now that I remember,
let's talk about your perspective.
We finished the plan on May. The plan was sent to the printers on May 27th, 1985. And the reason I know that date so well is because it was a Saturday. And our daughter Penny was born on Monday, May 29th.
That would be you
of
and
85,
Gay.
Me and Gay. And Gay was the one doing all of the writing. She had the only word processor in the whole agency. Everybody else was still using electric typewriters. She had the only word processor. That plan was put together on the word processor. She turned in the manuscript Saturday afternoon, and then we had Penny on Monday morning. So that was 85.
You got it all tied
yeah.
up.
Yeah, going back into that, one of the things that took place, and again, even going to when I was the first archaeologist hired on the National Forest in Texas. I was only the fourth one in the southern region. The other three archaeologists in the southern region at the time were Kent Schneider, who was our regional archaeologist in Atlanta, a gentleman named Jack Keller, that was designated as a zone archaeologist. He was responsible for Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and half of Tennessee. No, I don't guess he had Tennessee. He may have had part of Alabama. He may have had the western part of Alabama. And then the other archaeologist in the region was a gentleman named Wayne Prokopetz. And Wayne was stationed in Florida, but he basically had all of the eastern forest. Florida, the two Carolinas, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia. Not long after I got hired, they hired an archaeologist in Virginia, a guy named Mike Barber. And then gradually over the next few years, we started getting archaeologists on other forests, kind of the same jobs I had. But so at the time that they hired me, there was the only other resource specialist, someone that was very focused. You had one wildlife biologist on the forest and one soil scientist on the forest. That was it. Everybody else was foresters or engineers. So at the same time that I was starting.
So was the wildlife person and the soils person involved with the plan, the 76
yeah.
plan?
Okay. Yeah, they were. But again, what was transpiring during that time as we were moving forward into the planning, the full forge planning, we realized we didn't have the expertise on staff on some of these things that we needed to be discussing and deciding. We knew nothing about botany, or the understory component of the forest, the understory and midstory. We knew it was there. We knew it. We didn't like it in most cases, but we didn't know anything about where the bugs. Yeah, we knew where the bugs and the snakes were. We knew what snakes were important and which ones weren't, but we didn't know anything about.
Right.
I mean, there was no emphasis on quail management or turkey management. So one of the things that was happening during this period of time was that the biology group was expanding. The soil scientist was getting more directly involved with some geophysical specialists in terms of something on a broader scale than just soils, mapping soils. So we had in 1983, we hired, I think, four more biologists, one for each forest and one other, an additional one in the SO. So we had five biologists. One of them was a fisheries person. The others were...
Were you burning yet?
We were burning, but not on
we're
the scale...
Prescribed
we were prescribed burning, but not on the scale we're doing now.
So were you burning before you started? Do you know if they were...
They were burning, but it was more...
I'm not talking about slash burn or anything. I'm talking about...
Yeah, it wasn't to the extent.
Okay.
They were still prescribed... I mean, they were prescribed burning, but it was small parcels, small tracts, and it was really intended for mid-story control.
Do you know what percentage of the forest was still natural forest when you began? You know,
less than 1%.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
Less than 1%. The only reason I know that answer...
That's counting the bottoms, though. I mean, right?
Well,
that's
counting the bottoms. That's counting the land on the lower end of Rayburn that's in the horseshoe below the dam. That's been virtually untouched.
Am I asking the right question? Are you answering the question I'm asking?
I don't know. When you say natural forest,
how much had not been converted to plantation? Yeah,
had not been converted to plantation? Probably between 7 and 10%.
Really?
That had not been converted to plantation.
That much?
Yeah.
Wow.
In those areas that hadn't, the only reason was because they hadn't figured out how the hell to get into them yet. You know, they were either in locations where you couldn't build a road and have it hold up, or they were locations that were in some cases landlocked, and we were such bad neighbors, the neighbors wouldn't give us permission to cross, and there was no other way in. And then, like I said, there was a lot of the bottoms, and particularly on.
Of course, again, to be fair or to be accurate, much of the land the Forest Service got was the most cut over lands. It was the rejects.
And it had all been replanted.
Private companies.
It had all been replanted in the 30s and 40s, and even in some cases the early 50s.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So anyway, we were like I said. So there was this push to bring on additional or specialists in different areas, like I said, fisheries biologists, several wildlife biologists that were more attuned to woodpecker management, quail management, those kinds of things. We had a entomologist we brought on, and in fact, he's still here. He's still working.
Who's that?
Stephen Clark. And I asked him, I said, we haven't had an SPB outbreak in 20 years. He said, I'm doing a good job, ain't I? but anyway, so we started bringing in different specialists, resource specialists that were all
in the 80s.
This was in the 80s and early 90s. And we had all been educated during the 70s. We had all been brought up under Earth Day and NEPA and all that. So we had a little bit different philosophy.
So where's the money coming from?
The money's still coming from timber. From timber sales.
Okay.
And I was reminded of that constantly, for the entirety of my career, that any money I got for cultural resources came from
trees cut down.
Things that were being generated by trees being cut down. Or oil wells being built. So that's just a fact of life. That's the way the budget structure is. Now, we don't have near enough time today or this month for me to get into a rant about the budgeting stuff in the Forest Service. But it, again, it was...
So was this going on all across the South?
It was at different levels. At different levels.
I mean, were other Southern Forest units kind of doing the same thing?
They were kind of doing the same thing. We were pretty much in the forefront.
Because we were the first, of the lawsuit?
Or? We were, because of the lawsuit. Because we were the first forest in the region to start a forest-wide management plan. Now, others followed quickly within a year or two. But we were, if not the first, at least one of the first. And again, it was because of the visibility of the lawsuit, the kind of the upper-level consciousness of it, those kinds of things, that got us with our foot in the door to start that process. But other forests in the region were doing the same thing. By 1995, fiscal year 95 or October of 94, every forest in the region at that point had at least one archaeologist on staff. And then by 1999 or early 2000, most of us had anywhere from two to five archaeologists on staff. And we would have a forest archaeologist and then a sub-staff of anywhere from two to five people.
So the ones you had, did you hire?
I hired, yeah.
Now, what were you looking for? Degree-wise,
I had to look for at least a bachelor's degree, preferably a master's degree. I looked for people with prior experience because I didn't have time to babysit, was my thinking. I needed people that could come in, hit the ground running, knew what they needed to do, understood the nuances of surveying in a wooded area, understood the philosophical as well as the legal requirements for doing work and why we did the work and those kinds of things. So cast a wide net initially.
So you don't need to necessarily, unless you want to, mention personal names, but where would someone get that kind of experience? I mean, the people you're looking for.
Most of them came from either all of them came from either academia, fresh out of grad school and had done field schools, or they came from the contract world where they were doing the work that I'd done initially, working for a firm or working for a university, doing as much field work as they could get their hands on. And that's primarily the people that were skilled and had done a lot of field work already, because like I said, I didn't want to take the time, nor did I have the time, to babysit and teach. They needed to already know what to do once they arrived on the forest. My first hire was an assistant in the SO, a gentleman named Bob Skiles that stayed around two and a half years, I guess, and then went to the General Land Office in Austin and finished his career there. And then Bob helped me actually hire the first four district archaeologists for each forest.
Were you able to pay what you thought was pretty competitive?
We were able to pay. We initially hired, at that point...
Were these full-time, full
benefits?
They were full-time, full
benefits. At least the professional, the GS, they were GS-9s, which I forget what that pay rate was at the time. It was maybe $35,000, $36,000 a year. Decent salary. Better than what you could get in the contract world for similar experience. I've been fighting this respiratory thing now for a month.
I think it's this changing weather.
And I can't shake this cough. I started out, when we talk about pay scales, when I started under the IPA, I was the equivalent of what was then a GS-5. In federal service. GS-5s made maybe $15,000-$16,000 a year. And I was in hog heaven. Hell, it was all the money I needed. I could pay my rent, could pay my car note, had money to spend. I was happy as could be. But I started out when I became permanent when I was first hired permanent in 84, I moved up to GS9. And my original hiring was as a 9/11. And under the federal rules, when you get hired under that kind of a multi-grade position, you serve basically 2 years as in a probationary status as the 9, and then you're promoted automatically to 11 after 2 years, unless you screw up. And then they extend your probationary period until you fix whatever problems you have. So I started out permanently as a 9, and then 2 years later became a GS-11. So when I hired anybody that I hired after that, had to be of a grade level below mine as GS-9s.
There wasn't a 10?
There wasn't a 10.
Okay.
There were GS-10s,
but not in
the archaeology job descriptions. Your GS-10s actually were like heavy equipment operators, firefighters. Some of those kinds of jobs were GS-10s. Everything else was on like a 9, 7, 9, 11, 12, 13, 14 kind of was the progression.
Except for 14, those are odd numbers.
Yeah.
So they just put you over at the odds.
The 13s and 14s are forest supervisors,
okay,
and regional foresters. I think now the regional foresters may actually be 15s. I'm not sure. There was kind of a creep over the years. I forget what the current forest supervisor here, I believe, is a... He must be a 13. Because when I promoted into the staff position, I became a... No, he's a 14 because I...
Is it still Eddie?
It's still Eddie, yeah.
And what's his last name?
Eddie Taylor.
Yeah,
I think he's a 14. Because my job as a staff officer, I was a 13. Those 3 years I did that job. Wasn't worth it. But that's another story for another day, maybe.
Okay,
So anyway, I hired Bob.
So you're hiring staff.
I'm hiring staff. I hired Bob in, I guess it was 93. And then before he left for GLO, we hired our first group of district archaeologists. Several of them stuck around. Several stayed a year or two and then moved on to other jobs, other places.
So are you still having to go, or not, maybe that's not the right verb, but so are you still chasing timber? Or when did you get to the point where you could say, here's what we'd like to do, and I'm getting to Aldridge? So like if you're going to do a dig at Aldridge or around Ratcliffe Lake?
One of the things, now, going back to the forest plan and how it was driving things, like I said, we had the 1986 plan. It was to be revised in 1996. Okay? Well, because of the lawsuit, we hadn't actually implemented any of the things we said we were going to do in the 86 plan. Because they sued us, they added their problems with the plan, they added to the lawsuit. So until we got the lawsuit resolved, we really couldn't implement anything. But we went ahead forward with a plan revision in 96. Now, one of the components of that was a heritage management plan that we did for the forest, where we laid out priority areas for survey, where we think site densities are high. We laid out our priorities for site interpretation, site evaluation, and a process where we could... Because finally get to the point where we were making eligibilities of determination for sites. For many, many years, and it's still a factor today, but for particularly all those early years, our philosophy was what was called flag and avoid.
Flag and avoid.
I would find a site, I would flag a barrier around it, just using flag and tape, a buffer, the site area plus a buffer, and we'd say, take that half acre or three quarters acre out of your timber sale. And then we would walk off and leave it.
Did you get opposition?
We really didn't, because nobody wanted to spend the money it was going to take to do an evaluation.
But I mean, there were no timber people saying, no, we got to get
the timber people much preferred us doing that because they would have to pay for the evaluation, for the excavation part.
Oh.
And that was just more money coming out of their pockets, and they didn't really want to do that. And that was the case all over the Southeast, all across the region. For 25, 30 years, flagging a void was our mantra. And then, like I said, in 95...
And the intent was to maybe come back later.
But there was never a later.
There was never a later.
You never got the opportunity to go back. So, again, we were trying to kind of get out in front of things. So when we wrote this plan in 95, we...
I'm sorry to keep going back to that, but would this be something that... What drove the decision to say, okay, this particular spot, what did you think might be there?
Well, I would shovel test and try to define the boundaries. Yeah.
You had to find something.
It might be a projectile point. Might be all I find on an area. Or I might find, might dig 10 shovel tests and there'd be lithic artifacts in all 10 of them.
So then,
ceramic artifacts.
Would you consult topo maps? Everything
was based on topography, and the whole premise of the predictive modeling that we used was based on topography and landforms, aspect, that kind of stuff.
Soil types.
We never really. I kept trying to get the soil scientists to work with me on trying to further refine the relationship of soil types. But again, he was looking at things in a much broader macro scale and didn't really have time, because he was plenty busy as well, didn't have time to mess with me.
were most caddo sites on the similar, same soil type?
Most of them were the ones...
How predictive could you be?
Yeah. We got pretty good. It wasn't until late 90s, early 2000s, that we got really comfortable with our predictive model for caddo sites. But we were probably 75-80% accurate.
How much, like a ratio between topography and soil types? Is it geared more towards topography?
It geared more towards topography.
And I know they're connected.
Yeah. The only soil type thing I can put my finger on was that we generally, when we had a caddo site that involved a residence, a house, because we had sites with caddo artifacts but no structures. But on the occasions where we had caddo sites with structures, the soils varied more to a loamy sand rather than a sandy loam. It's a fine distinction, I know. But it was a denser, more compact, and that's probably because of the continuousness of the occupation, where the soil was compacted by the constant traffic and use and what have you.
Now, how much did the clear cutting practices disturb some of that? That would have
in those cases, in the cases of caddo sites with structures, there was no disturbance at all from that because they were in the bottoms. They were down primarily hardwoods. There might be the example on the Davy Crockett where we found the most caddo sites with structures.
How much shovel testing or how much digging would you have to do to determine if it was a house or not a house?
Well, that was hit and miss. That was pure luck to pick up a feature in a shovel. It was hard to pick up features in shovel tests.
Because, I mean, to find if it was a house, isn't that like a hearth or a...
A hearth or the tree ring, the post,
yeah, the post,
post or the post pattern.
How deep would those posts tip?
The hole that's dug to support the post are generally less than a foot deep.
Yeah, that's what I think they would be. So
generally you would find the post hole patterns very close to the surface. And again, the areas where we recorded structures, several on the Davy Crockett, and they were really just sandy ridges right off the river. I mean, they were sandy enough, though, and high enough elevation that they had pine on them. So you're going down through the bottom, and you start seeing these small stands of pine. Well, you knew you had a sandy landform there, so we'd go test there. And sure enough, we'd find caddo ceramics, or we'd find projectile points, or whatever. Once we kind of nailed that down. But again, those were in bottoms areas. They hadn't been harvested. The only time they might, there was one on the David Crockett. The only reason we were down there is because there had been a tornado. And we had tornado damage in the area. Didn't damage the site, but it was near enough by. We looked over and, oh, let's go look over there. And
So timber guys are going to want to come in and salvage, right, the bottoms.
Yeah.
So when do y'all go
Let me
in?
Take
when
a break and go, sure, sure. go to the bathroom.
Sure, let me pause this. Okay, we're back, and John may remember, but I have forgotten what we were last talking about. And we actually took probably about a 20-minute break. So I think we've agreed that he's going to come back another time, and we'll try to maybe pick up where we left off and finish up. But in the meantime, for the next few minutes that we have, I think he's going to talk to me a little bit about grazing and kind of the overall perspective of the changes.
Yeah. Well, when I started with the Forest Service in the winter of 79, we had an active grazing program. Grazing and range management were actually key components of the Forest Service mission for many, many years, and even today in some places. We had I don't remember how many allotments we had on the forests themselves, probably on average of 10 to 15 per forest. Were referred to as grazing allotments. And basically what those were areas that were dedicated to individuals. They paid a permit price and a cost per acre to graze their cattle. They had to abide by certain regulations and rules, of course. But it was a pretty sweet deal because...
Did you require that their cattle be branded?
The cattle had to be branded and tagged.
And tagged.
Yeah. So we had, like I said, probably 10 to 15 allotments per forest as far as the Sabine, the Angelina, and the David Crockett. I'm not sure, I don't remember there being a lot of grazing on the Sam Houston.
Now, were the allotments fenced?
They were fenced, yeah. Fenced and cross-fenced.
Whose responsibility were they?
The initial fence construction was done by the Forest Service, but the maintenance and repairs were the responsibility of the permittee.
And the whole allotment was fenced in.
Right.
And all enclosed.
And then any other facilities that were needed, whether it be corrals or pens or whatever, were the responsibility of the permittee in the allotment. And you know, grazing goes back, like I said, it was a key component of the Forest Service mission. One of the historical, I'll say artifacts, but one of the historical components that I recorded over the years were large dipping vats from the screw worm control in the 1930s, where they would fill them up with arsenic, have the cows jump in, and the arsenic would kill all the bugs. Cows would walk or swim down it and then climb out. Then they'd rinse them off with water. We learned really quickly that you don't do soil samples around those for about 30 feet around them because there's still arsenic in the soil. Basically, when I talked earlier about flag and avoid, we would flag those and avoid them. It wasn't a problem for anybody.
But these were concrete.
Most of them were concrete. There were a couple, as I recall, in the David Crockett, that were brick lined rather than concrete.
Are they still protected? Or?
They're still, as far as I know, they're still protected. Yeah, as we got into GPS and all that, and later years where we could go out and get accurate plots of where they were. We went ahead and recorded those, then put them into the land base classification as areas to be avoided. We were able to do that.
Two at Boggy Slough. One is still intact.
Is it?
Yeah, concrete. Yeah, they date to the 10s.
You don't want to go in the 1910s. Don't go. You don't want to get in the bottom of one of those.
No. Well, one that's intact still holds liquid.
There were two that we were
and a family of water moccasins.
Yeah. There were two that we discovered on the Sabine up near East Hamilton that were different from all the others that we had seen. They were at the exit end of the pit was about a 30 to 40 foot half moon shaped concrete pad. Basically, I guess that was their drip pad where they had them come out and then they would wash them off and drip them on that concrete. I guess they thought they were, I don't know what they thought was happening to the runoff, but those were unique. I hadn't seen that particular style anywhere else.
And they're probably right next to a railroad, right?
They were close to a railroad, yeah.
So
they were in that area around East Hamilton.
Going all the way back to the late 19th, early 20th century, it was Texas fever.
Yeah.
And to ship a cow out of the county, it was county by county, you had to certify that it had been dipped before you could transport them. So most of them were railroads.
Kind of between Ragtown and Huxley, kind of in that area. And we found those during the blowdown surveys that we were doing in the late 90s.
Did you find any foundations for like silos or anything? Any kind of circular concrete?
Not associated with the grazing program.
Okay.
There were now up on the grasslands, there were some features up there that had been there for a long time, corrals and pens and feeding troughs that had been there since the 30s. That were well built. They hadn't been. There's no timber management up there, but so anyway, we had, like I said, we had a range management specialist that was over the grazing program when I started. He left in probably about the time we were working on the midway through the original forest plan, an 85 plan, 86 plan, and. One of the conclusions we had reached in the planning process was that our grazing allotments were too dense. It was causing soil erosion, loss of seedlings. There were some knockdown dragouts between our timber staff and our grazing specialist about the impacts of cows on plantations. And they got to the point where they just had to agree to disagree. They were never going to agree on anything, so it wasn't a big deal, but basically that 86 plan called for a general reduction in our grazing allotments, with the eventual getting to zero within that first 10-year period, and we basically achieved that.
So getting like number of cows per acre,
getting going from having allotments to having no grazing program on the forest at all. So that by the time we started the revision in 96, there were no grazing allotments anywhere on the forest or the grasslands.
So how long were these allotments? A year, 2 years?
The permits, I think, were 2 years,
okay. Maybe
three.
So it took maybe no more than 3 years?
It took like two or three cycles
to phase it out.
Of renewals to phase it out. Met with some opposition, but really it wasn't.
Do you recall any who the biggest... could a person get more than one allotment?
Yeah. Yeah, there were, as far as I know, there were no limits on that.
Were you having to turn people away?
We did a pretty good job of...
I mean, when you were doing it, when it was an ongoing thing, were there more people applying than you could...
I don't think so. No, I think in most of the, from what I recall, and I wasn't that deeply involved in that aspect of it, but most of the allotments that we had... still in the late 70s, had been families going back to the 30s that had just kept the allotments in the family, just continual.
Any names off the chain?
No, I really don't.
Okay.
I remember the range specialist's name. It was a guy named Clem Kearley. He ended up, he left here, went to Colorado. He actually ended up being a forest supervisor up in Colorado for many years. I don't remember any of the names of the allotments.
Were they mostly Bremer, Brahman cattle?
Yeah, Brahman. Or
Brahman Cross.
Brahman Cross. They're just standard scrub cows, which you would find on anywhere out here. But again, I don't remember there being a whole lot of complaints when we started phasing it out. Because I think the cattle industry was starting... to suffer from the, I don't know what else, I don't remember the particular socioeconomic markets, things that were happening, but it really became less and less a deal. And we probably got more pushback up on the grasslands. Again, the grasslands were you know, our mission up there was different than it was on the National Forest.
What counties are those in?
Wise County and Fannin County.
Wise and Fannin. Okay.
And, of course, you know, that's cowboy country, cattle country. Chisholm Trail goes through the LBJ grasslands. So everybody, you know, the grasslands, it's for grazing. Well, what we were doing, or what was happening, we were converting all the bunch grass prairies, the tall grass, and truck grass, bunch grasses, in the other components, converting that to coastal for grazing in hay.
Coastal Bermuda,
which doesn't hold the soil together nearly as well as what the bunch grasses do. So we were, rather than fixing the erosion problems up there, we were exacerbating them. So when we started looking at it from more of a soil's impact perspective, we probably had, I forget what the number was, it was exorbitant, huge percentage, 70-80% more cows per acre than it could sustain. So again, we were able, it took several cycles, but we were able to eventually phase out grazing completely on the grasslands. And then as we were phasing out the grazing, we were doing conversions using deep plows and ripping implements and getting rid of the coastal and coming back and planting bunch grasses, tall grass, prairie grasses to try to restore the natural vegetation. Probably a 70-80% success rate when I left the agency as far as my recollection of what was happening. I think it's gotten better. They've also realized that fire is a component of that, so they're doing more burning up there now than they used to.
Did you ever do any archaeological studies there connected with the Chisholm Trail?
Not connected with the Chisholm Trail. We were, our management activities up there were few and far between. And the way we approach things up there is that they would select an area, say, again, and then there's 30, between the two units, there's 37,000 acres. So they would pick areas based upon current conditions in terms of sheet erosion, eroded ravines, things like that, that needed to be repaired and stabilized. So they would take a couple of segments, and it may be 200 to 400 acres total. And they would develop plans, restoration plans, and it would take, it was a 2 to 5 year framework that they had because of the way the funding was coming in, mm-hmm. to get the work done once it was approved. So I would get copies of those plans, schedule a period of time to go up and survey, and then we would survey the entirety of the project and then come back and write a report. And then as they implemented it over the next few years, they were able to do what they needed to do. The only way we were able to handle that workload up there was the fact that there's nothing there other than a few historic homesteads. All the soil strata where you would have had prehistoric occupations was blown away or eroded away during the Dust Bowl. You look at pictures of the grasslands in the 30s, and it's a barren desert, basically.
When did the government get that land?
It was originally acquired under the auspices of a little-known agency called the Bureau of Reclamation. And, again, that was a New Deal project. So the lands were acquired in the late 30s, 38, 39.
Oh, okay.
So I think we had some records maybe of in the 40s, early 40s, 1940, early 41. But most of them were 38, 39 time period. Immediately after the war, that land was transferred over to what became NRCS, the Soil Conservation Service, managed it, and they were doing soil erosion stabilization, those kinds of things, building lakes and what have you, to try to stop the erosion. I got to go back because, yeah, some of those authorizing legislation for acquisition up there had to have happened in 35 or 36 because some of the first units acquired were in 1937, and then you had CCC and WPA projects in 38 and 39 that were built strictly on the Fannin County side.
Is NRCS under USDA?
Yeah, they're under USDA too. Okay. Used to be called Soil Conservation Service.
But the Bureau of Land...
the Bureau of Reclamation was under Department of Interior.
Okay.
And I don't know exactly when. It was somewhere during the war years right after the war that it was transferred to SCS. And then within USDA, they were transferred to Forest Service in the early 1970s, 71, 72, somewhere in there. And what made part of our work easier up there was that the acquisition records were the most thorough things I've ever seen. There would be folders that would be upwards of an inch, 2 inches thick, with inventories of all the livestock, any other domestic animals, the number of people living on the property.
Who were the typical owners? Was it multiple owners?
It was a lot of tenant farmers.
But, I mean, who owned the land?
The land was owned by a handful of, at the time of acquisition, most of it had been foreclosed and was owned by banks.
Okay.
There were a handful of family ownerships, but even they still had, they were absentee owners, yeah. They still had tenant farmers.
But yeah, then you have a lot of tenants residing on the
land. But you had, again, in there you had detailed maps of the property, all the improvements on it, where they were located, where the houses were located, where the cattle pens were located.
Now, is all that stuff in Fort Worth? The documentation of that? Was that in Lufkin?
We had it in Lufkin.
Wow.
And when I left in 11, we had, at least at that point, won the war. And those land records were still in Lufkin.
Now would there be any kind of like acknowledgement of tenancy records included in that?
Some. I mean, there were warranty deeds. There were titles.
Because, I mean, there would have to be something in place for the government records, to kind of say, okay, we're the new owners now.
Yeah.
And again, the tenants were given
an actually shorter period of time to vacate than they were on the forest.
On the forest.
Yeah.
I've not asked Juanita about that in a while. We're digressing, but that'd be an interesting historical.
But they were still on the forest. I don't remember exactly where those files were located when we moved into the new building. I would assume they're still there. I don't think they've been sent off. Because, again, we considered those to be working historical documents because we're still doing projects up there. And that's our first research, was to go back to those land records and see, okay, who lived here, when did they vacate, what buildings did they have here, where were those located, what other facilities might have been out there in terms of windmills and transportation and that kind of thing. Very helpful in doing a lot of work. And again, we didn't, up there, we could do everything by surface survey, so we could progress pretty quickly on a project because we weren't having to shovel test because there was nothing to shovel test.
Blown away, huh?
You know, we were walking across B and C horizon soils. And in that country, there's just no archaeology in those horizons. It's all above it. Now you do get, and particularly on the Fannin County side around the Sulphur River, you've got a paleontological component there that we would pay a little bit of attention to. But again, it was generally 30, 40 foot deep, and you only find it in exposed banks of the Sulphur River or one of its main tributaries. And then there were marine fossils on the Wise County side, but they were surface. And everybody knew where they were. Nobody collected them. It wasn't a big deal. But so anyway, all that to say, by the mid-90s, we were out of the grazing business on the National Forest and the National Grasslands both. And as far as I know, there's been no impetus, no inquiries about reinstating any kind of grazing allotment.
Okay, well, I think for today that'll conclude our interview. And
it's been fun.
And thank you. And
chronologically, we're only up to the mid-90s.
Okay. Yeah, there's still quite a bit to talk about. But
I don't think I've told too many war stories.
No, not yet.
I'll tell you one historical commission story.
Do you want this on the recorder?
No, I'll turn the recorder off.
Okay, all right. I'll turn it off.